Welcome to Awakening Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today in conversation with Will Rosenzweig. My name is Nipun and I will be your host. Here's how our call is going to work. In a few minutes, our moderator, Lynn Lawrence, will engage in deep dialogue with our speaker. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and circular sharing. So Lynn, I'm happy that you'll be taking on this conversation here today. I know you're super excited. You have been super excited, I think, probably for about a year when mm-hmm. we originally thought of bringing Will on. Would love for you to just give everyone a little bit of an insight into who you are and what connects you to this call before I introduce Will.
Thank you so much, Nipun. Yeah, I think that's a great, thank you for that insight into me. What I'd like to just give a glimpse of now is sort of how I'm connected to this call in two ways. The idea for it, this particular call, came out of a video call I was on with Nipun, where there was an entrepreneurial effort we were resonating with. And I offered that I'd never encountered a more useful book than Will's regarding how an idea becomes a business. And then Nipun sent me a follow-up email saying we should have Will for a call. And so we'll discuss that book a bit during the call because that's a great resource. And the other dimension in which I'm connected here that's really exciting is that I was in the same high school class as Will. So I have a bit of a special perspective there, which I'll share as well.
High school, wow. Well, that is,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I have to zoom through the intro so we can get to the fun stuff. So let me just, for those of you that haven't read the online tidbit, here's a brief summary of Will's background. He's a person of incredible character is what I would say. But here's a little bit more. He has spent more than 25 years integrating practices and perspectives of an entrepreneur, a venture investor, and an educator. Will was a founding CEO, and I think his business card read Minister of Progress at the Republic of Tea, a specialty tea company that is actually credited with creating premium tea category in the U.S., sip by sip rather than gulp by gulp. Talk about slowing it down. Republic of Tea now is celebrating its 25th anniversary in 2017. But Will, as an entrepreneur and investor, he's been involved in all kinds of major companies from Odwalla, Trinity Springs, WineTasting.com, Yumly, and brand new brands, a functional food incubator he founded in 2004. In 2010, Will was honored with the Oslo Business for Peace Award that I referenced earlier. That's an award given by a committee of Nobel laureates. And in his accepting speech, Will said Will had a beautiful talk, but here's a paragraph which I think is really inspiring. And here's Will. He says, quote, "The people who know me best know that at heart I'm just a quiet gardener. A gardener sees the world as a system of interdependent parts where healthy, sustaining relationships are essential to the vitality of the whole. A real gardener is not a person who cultivates flowers, but a person who cultivates the soil. In business, this is translated for me into the importance of developing agreements and partnerships where vision and values, purpose and intent are explicitly articulated, considered, and aligned among all stakeholders of an enterprise." So that's the kind of person Will is. He's pioneered and, in fact, taught the first MBA course in social entrepreneurship and social venture development at Haas School of Business at my alma mater, UC Berkeley. He's been there on faculty since 1999. Currently, he's teaching with Alice Waters of Chez Panisse, with the most popular undergraduate class at UC Berkeley, Edible Education. We hope to hear more about that, but it's a course that explores the future of food and its diverse systems and movements. And lastly, most recently, we'll join forces with the Culinary Institute of America, not to be confused with the other CIA, to launch the Food Business School, the CIA's new Center for Executive and Graduate Education. He's the Dean and Executive Director at the Food Business School at the Culinary Institute of America, really trying to support a lot of innovation that addresses the world's most pressing food challenges. So it is an honor, Will, to have you on this call, to have this conversation, and to get a chance to learn a little bit from you. Welcome, Will.
Thank you, Nipun. It's a pleasure and honor to be here with you and Lynn. And really looking forward to our conversation this morning.
Absolutely, absolutely. I hand it over to Lynn.
Oh, great. So so in our circle, we're interested in stories of transformation. And I thought since we're addressing such a significant body of work, how to sort of begin. And I know that... maybe almost as much as Will loves his garden, he loves words and words with precision. And so I've chosen four words that I know Will loves to frame our conversation. And they are serendipity, potential, sustainability, and eudaimonia. So the first, serendipity, from my viewpoint, there have been so many serendipitous events in Will's life, but my favorite is the story of the inception of Republic of Tea, and also the book that was born then. So maybe, Will, you could begin there.
Well, thanks, Lynn, and I really appreciate your own embrace of that book, which has been mentioned. It's called The Republic of Tea, How an Idea Becomes a Business. It was published in 1992, and it itself was kind of an accident, like the company itself. I was in my late 20s, and I had just become a father, and I was just embracing the responsibility of having another family member, my first child, and was kind of beset with kind of the awe of becoming a parent and the need and the desire to provide and, safety and security. It was interesting. A whole kind of set of energies kicked into me that I was not acquainted with. And so I was working to figure out how to kind of provide that support. And I had had an offer to become part of a publishing company, and I was getting ready to accept a job. In the meantime, I was invited to a conference on the East Coast. It was a conference that was organized by a group called the Social Venture Network, which was very early in its formation. And during this weekend conference in rural New Jersey, I had a chance to meet some truly remarkable and inspiring people who were bringing their energy and their values and their ideals into the world of business to try to create a better world. And many of the people that I met were quite a bit older than me, I mean 10 or 15 years older than me, which was old enough to feel almost not a whole generational gap, but definitely, of a different stage of life. And during this weekend, I just witnessed people that were so committed to what they were doing. I met, just to mention some of the people I met in one weekend, it was quite amazing. I met Ben and Jerry of the Vermont ice cream fame. I met Paul Hawken, who is back in the news now with his new book, Drawdown. I met Jeff Hollander, who was one of the founders of Seventh Generation, and Gary Hirschberg, one of the founders of Stonyfield Farm. It was such an amazing gathering, and I was really swept up in that meeting, and I felt something kind of wake up in me. And it created a little sense of confusion because I was about to go down another path, more of a secure path, take a job. So anyway, just to cut ahead, but I was supposed to leave the conference very early on Sunday morning and fly back to California. And on that flight, I was supposed to meet up with the man who was hiring me for this other job. And he had generously arranged for me to sit next to him in first class to fly across the country so we could negotiate the final terms of my contract. So I got up very early, like 4 o'clock in the morning. Went out to the lobby to get a cab, which I had arranged the night before, and lo and behold, the cab did not come. I was sitting alone in this lobby. This is 1990, so no cell phones, no way to text, no way to contact either the gentleman I was supposed to travel with or the cab company, and I was anxious, and lo and behold, I missed my plane. I was sort of sitting on my suitcase in the lobby of the hotel, and this guy walked up to me, and he said, you look a little lost. Are you going to the airport? I said, yeah. He said, I'm going to the airport, too. And would you like a ride? So he had a car coming, and we got in the car a little bit later, and it turned out he was also flying to San Francisco. And we got to Newark Airport, and I changed my flight. I ended up on the same flight as him, and we ended up changing our seats around. We sat next to each other on this plane. It was very, as we said, Lynn, serendipitous. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was serendipitous at the time, but anyway, flew, got on the plane, took off, and somewhere over Philadelphia, the flight attendant offered us coffee, and we both asked for tea, which was kind of unusual. And we were served tea, which was probably the worst tea I've had in my life at that point. We both made a grimacing face and had the same reaction, which is like, why can't you get a decent cup of tea when you need it? And that provoked and catalyzed a six-hour conversation about tea. And it turned out my seatmate was quite a remarkable entrepreneur and visionary. It was Mel Ziegler, who had been the founder of the Banana Republic, and he also was at that conference. I didn't meet him during the conference, but I met him, obviously, on the way to the airport. And we just were completely enthralled in a conversation like I've never had about all of the attributes of tea, how it is a beverage of health and well-being, how it's rooted in a spiritual practice in Japan. We each shared our own experiences with tea. He had come to tea fairly recently because he had to defect from coffee because coffee and coffee withdrawals from the caffeine were giving him migraine headaches. And so he was kind of new to tea and discovering tea and the rich spectrum of different types of tea. And I've been a tea drinker all my life and had never actually had a cup of coffee. Anyway, 6 hours later, we land. We're getting ready to land. I am just so alive and inspired in this conversation. And I said, why don't we start a tea company? And he sort of paused and said, well, I don't know if I am up to starting another company right now, but I'm happy to think about it with you. But I've got an idea for a name. And he threw out, how about the Republic of Tea? And I just blurted out, well, I'll be the Minister of Progress. And lo and behold, we got off the plane, we shook hands, went in different directions, and I got back to my study, and I wrote him a fax. For those of you that remember what a fax machine was, this is before we used email, but I sent a fax, and he sent me back a fax, and it turned out we both loved to write, and we corresponded. We started writing letters to each other about this idea for a business. We started dreaming it up together, and then his wife, Patricia, who's a very talented artist, started to chime in with little drawings, and we ended up generating about 400 pages of letters and ideas and concepts and research in about 6 weeks.
Wow.
It was just the most remarkable burst of inspiration. But, you know, I'll pause, Lynn, because just to recap, the serendipity was, you know, the unintended outcome of having one plan and all of a sudden having it be sort of changed before your very eyes. So the best laid plans all of a sudden turn into something else. And in the most unexpected way. But behind that was some preparation. You know, Joseph Campbell, the wonderful mystic and humanitarian and who wrote The Hero's Journey and really helped us understand, you know, how mythology plays into the patterns of our lives. He described in The Hero's Journey that most hero's journeys begin at some strange point of departure where you're not familiar with your surroundings, where you're out of your element. And that certainly was the case for me at this conference in New Jersey. So unbeknownst to me at the time, I had taken the first step toward, you know, embarkation on a serendipitous journey.
So, Will, the book that was a result of those faxes, the real-time conversations back and forth. So personally, myself, I give away a few copies of that book every month in response to a question from someone that is very similar to a question that has come in on our live stream from Mexico City. I have a project, an early stage here in Mexico, called Cultivating Good Luck. Can I talk about it with you? I find many resonations with your philosophy and practice. Saludos. So whenever anyone says to me, you know, I've got this idea that I'm trying to help become into reality, I just go to my bookcase, because I always keep a couple copies on hand, and I hand them this book. And to me, there's nothing like it that my experience with software project development and what actually works is kind of woven into this as well. This is it's an organic process. And so that's why I think the book is so valuable for the conversation and also the tools that are embedded in the book, which they are not at all high tech, but they're very effective. There's a mind mapping of the idea of the company originally. There's a statement of values, your values, that you want to align originally with the company. And the appendix at the end has a business vision plan that is a template, I think, for anything of any type of business, really. And that plan has stood the test of time. Your plan for the Republic of Tea, right? The 25-year-old company?
Yeah. Well, Lynn, the thing about this that was so remarkable was, first of all, it was never intended to be a book.
Right.
It sprung from a passion and impulse, but it met a kind of a rigor and discipline in the fleshing out of the business. And I had the good fortune to have a mentor who had kind of been where I wanted to go. That relationship also was very confusing at times because we had very different needs in our lives. I was a wantrepreneur at the time. I wanted to have this be successful. I wanted to create, as I mentioned earlier, security and stability in my family. I wanted to be a good father and provider. And most importantly, I wanted to bring something special into the world that would touch people and move people. And while doing that, I wanted to create a really flourishing business. And so the letters were all of the expression of those hopes and ideals, and they were, you know, met with some wisdom and experience from another person. And it was really propelled along. But, you know, there's an interesting thing that happened, because 6 weeks in, my colleague said to me by fax again, he said, "Well, I'm pretty much done now. I've given you what I can. I've given you my thoughts." And I responded, "You know, why don't you start the business?" This is like after 6 weeks. And I was just not equipped. I was actually kind of shocked, because I thought originally that we were going to start the business together, and that we were going to be partners. And I thought that, you know, given his prior success, that he would want to invest and write a check. I had all these assumptions that were not correct. And so I was kind of let down, and I was a bit nervous about what would happen next. And I actually had to take another job, because I wasn't ready to start the company. I didn't know what I was really doing. I had explored a lot of creative ideas, but I had not unlocked what we would call the competitive advantage.
So it was not at all linear, this process. It was very organic.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a burst of joy and exploration, and then a very kind of curt stop and kind of regrouping. Mm-hmm. I think now in business school, we call that a pivot. The pivot was not away from the business, so to speak, but was to pivot because I was a young parent and I needed to support my family. And so I went and took a job working with a friend of mine in the design business. But I kept working with this idea, and the idea kept working deep. And it was just so alive in me that I kept researching. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because about this time, these letters, this big pile of faxes, were shared with another friend who had been at that conference. And he was reading the letters, and he said, "These letters should be a book about how to start a business. Do you mind if I send them to my friend at Doubleday?" So he copied a bunch of the letters, sent them to his friend at Doubleday, Harriet Rubin, who was a very talented editor at the time. She wrote back and said, "I'd like to publish these letters as a book about how to start a business." And I was just on cloud nine. You can imagine, you know, about 6 weeks earlier, I go to this conference, I meet this guy, we generate all these ideas. Now we've got a book offer from a leading publisher, and I was just, you know, so excited about everything that was happening. And he said, you know, kind of soberly, he said, "I don't think we should publish a book about how to start a business if we don't have a business." And he had a really good point. And it was also easy for him to say, because he had already had big success. So that's how it went. And to cut ahead, you know, 18 months later, after I finally figured out that what I was really missing was I didn't really know enough about tea. I had a lot of ideas about how to market tea. I had a good sense of what was missing in the marketplace. So I knew that, you know, people were getting really excited about specialty beverages. This was a good time when Starbucks had just kind of come on the scene and went public. So people were, you know, prepared to pay more for finer quality ingredients. And so, but I had to go become, honestly, a tea expert. And I got on a plane and I went to London. And I had another completely serendipitous experience, because I went to London based on an introduction someone had met that I also met at that social venture conference. And he was a gentleman who was in the tea trade. His family was involved for hundreds of years and owned tea plantations in India. And I had arranged, again, through faxes, to meet with this gentleman. He was going to sort of introduce me to the inner world of the tea trade. And when I arrived in London and I went to his office, it was at Sir John Lyon House, which was the big tea trading center in the city of London. I got there, and his secretary informed me, sadly, that he had just had a heart attack, and he was incapacitated, and he was not going to be able to meet me. And you can imagine, I went all the systems. You know, I was sad, obviously, about this man's condition. He did recover, which was good news. But I was a bit lost, and I was just stunned. But I was walking around this place, the Sir John Lyon House, and I went to the man that ran the Tea Association there, and I told him my story. And he, in turn, said, "Well, I think I know who you should meet. You should meet a man named Brian Ryder. Brian is a long-time tea trader and specialized in specialty tea." Anyway, again, it's a much longer story, but he, Brian, became my mentor and really took me under his wing. I was like the son that he didn't have at the time. He had three sons. I remember one was like a doctor, one was a lawyer, an accountant, and none of them were particularly that interested in the tea business at that time. And I kind of showed up, you know, similar ages as his own children, and with this wide-eyed curiosity and energy to change the world through tea. And so he became, again, serendipitously a very important person in my life. And I think, you know, just Lena left. Showing up.
Yeah. And so there you were at the right place at the right time. Say, Will, could you adjust your headset a little bit? It's like it when I said that I couldn't hear you.
I think somewhere in between, Will, you got really close, and it was we could hear your voice loud and clear, so I don't know if that's possible.
Is it better now?
Yeah.
It's better much now? Better now.
Okay.
Sorry
about that.
So I'll take this opportunity of a break, and I think it's so important, especially that the kids know that those up-and-coming know that about this organic journey that we go on. Often they see success and they think it's a linear path. I think that is very dangerous to expect that in life. And so I think it's so great, important to share how it goes, this serendipitous path. The next word that I had offered up was potential. And Will, when we did our pre-call, I think it was this Goethe quote, "Whatever you can do or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now." So speaking of potential, so back in high school, here was this very purposeful young man who I would often see, and being like an amateur poet, I would put the precise word that I would put on this, he would be striding. He often wore these black Converse high-top tennis shoes, which probably made him look like he was walking even faster. But he was always purposefully striding. I'm so used to seeing him as a leader because he was always leading something, whether it was in student government, in our publications, or performing, especially playing his trumpet for us. But he was also like in at least one musical. And there's one picture from the yearbook I especially think of with regard to him when he's in costume as a magician. We had hundreds of kids in our class and well over 1,000 in total. And there was a lot of talent in that school. And he'd just get up in front of them all and possibly in the beginning saying this very gently. Maybe in freshman year, he was still learning that trumpet a bit. So I think it was very vulnerable, but I really was impressed at that time by his courage. I thought him very courageous, and I learned a little bit more in doing the work for this about sort of the source of that courage being encouragement. So, Will, we talked a little bit about that. And that there was especially your dad at that time.
Yeah, I think that, encouragement of others is such a powerful resource. You know, it starts with attention, and it also involves kind of attention and care and nurturance and belief in one's potential. And I was just really blessed to have a father that was so generous with all of those kind of qualities. And he would always tell me that, you know, he believed in me, and he said, I know whatever you do, you will be successful. And that vote of confidence, that source of encouragement, although it turned out not necessarily to be true, because I certainly wasn't successful in everything that I did, but it gave me the confidence to at least try. And the other thing that I learned about this was that these characteristics of encouragement are also really vital to gardening. And my mother was a gardener, and she was always out growing plants and food. We grew up in Southern California where, as you recall, Lynn, everything grows. Mm-hmm. And was very fortunate. So I had sort of very interesting source of encouragement in my life. And as I've become older, and as I've worked as a teacher or a mentor or an entrepreneur, I take seriously the power of encouragement as a resource to help other people really achieve their potential. And if you think about people as being full of seeds, if you will, seeds of potential, we can take seriously our roles in helping people realize their potential and bring those seeds to fruition. Mm-hmm. And it's a different focus than a lot of our business world, which is very kind of celebrity oriented or individually oriented. You know, we celebrify, we make entrepreneurs into heroes. Mm-hmm. But effectively, everything that comes about, my experience in business, comes through people and a team of people. And in almost every case that I know, almost every business is started by a partnership or a team of people. Mm-hmm. And always, almost without exception, that story is rewritten either by one of the people who kind of prevails and carries on in the business. But if you go back into the founding of any great company, you know, Apple Computer, we know of two founders, the two Steves, but there was actually several other people who were instrumental in getting that company started. I'll often ask my students now at, you know, the undergrads who are in their late teens or early 20s, have you ever heard of Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft? No, you know, so I think that there's a dynamic where co-founders somehow encourage one another to take risks and to try things. And so I don't know, I think about that as a resource that I try to share with, you know, direction and intention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So still from within this frame of potential, you know, another thing, another sort of nonlinear piece that I would like the future generations to be aware of is you had a lot of different sort of talents and skills that you built upon, probably. So you had this early spirit of entrepreneurship, or you had this early entrepreneurial spirit, and then, you know, the magician, the musician, the mime, and you went to school for you studied film, and so that we sort of educate maybe more broadly, or so just with specific regard to you, I think that this was a key part of what was maybe seeded in you that built that potential.
Well, again, I was really privileged to, you know, well, we went to a public school, remember, Lynn, that actually had a lot of arts and a lot of crafts and a lot of opportunity for creative expression, not as a an elective or an after school activity, but you know, integral. We had a band, we had an orchestra, we had a choir, we had a lot of people participating. We had a theater. We, you know, the probably, you know, last week I had a really fun experience. One of my students from Edible Education came in my office hour, which I always enjoy. And he said to me, you know, I've really enjoyed this class. And I notice how comfortable you are up on the stage there with your guests. Mm-hmm. And you're always really good at kind of making this conversation interesting and carrying it forward. And he said, how do you do that? Like what he asked me, what should I do if I want to be able to do that? And I thought for a minute, I thought, you know, the most seminal experience I had to prepare me for that was improvisational theater in high school. Was, you know, the tenets of listening, of being present, of showing up, of responding to people in the affirmative. You know, in improv, we always learn this tool of yes and, because that's what carries an idea forward. It also, you know, prepares you to think on your feet and to engage and to collaborate and to co-create. And I, you know, so I was thinking about that again, that's kind of a lost, it teaches you how to play too. And one of the things that's so tough right now is I see so many of the students so concerned with their grades and their structure and the way they look, you know, to the outside world and how their resume looks and if they're going to be able to get a job. And it's just so intense. You know, it reminds me of the importance of being able to play and to show up and to collaborate.
Yeah, and that word play really transitions us nicely to the next frame, which is sustainability, because to be able to sustain anything over the long haul, you've got to have that refreshment in some form or fashion. It's got to sort of come from within, I think. So there's a podcast out there somewhere in the interwebs where Will is asked about his initiating one of the first venture funds dedicated specifically to social venture. And he's being asked his mindset around that. And instead of like giving some sort of analytical proof about how he thought it could work, what he first says is, I thought I could try. And you've already used that word in this session, try. And that put me so in mind of a fragment of Rilke from Letters to a Young Poet. If you have this love for what is humble and try very simply as someone who serves. I just think that's the perspective of that, as opposed to what you were just saying about it, the pressures on to succeed, whatever that means nowadays. And so sustainability seems, Will, a viewpoint from which you view just about everything. And I think now we should dive into the garden a bit, and both actually and metaphorically. So tell me how the origin of your gardening interest.
Well, let me go just take off a little bit on your words there, Lynn, because I think humility is such an important idea, and it's a power. Humility is a source of energy, and humility comes from a recognition that your own power comes from without. It comes from the other. Again, in our culture, in our society, we think about the self and the power of the self. But when you embrace notions of humility, you really realize that your source of inspiration, your source of wisdom, your source of guidance comes from without. And that takes me right into the garden, because in the garden, there's nothing you know, there's nothing more humbling than being a gardener, because in the garden you are interceding with living nature and, you know, trying to shape it and arrange it and design it and nurture it in a way that it creates an ever-changing kind of environment that can envelop and inspire and relax. And, you know, the other word, Lynn, that I think of now since we've been talking about this, sustainability is a perplexing word, and it's particularly perplexing in the business world because it's kind of been used in so many different ways. Nobody really knows what it means. I mean, we can talk about human sustainability, but the problem with sustainability, it sounds like status quo. It sounds kind of like entropy. The words that are emerging now that I think are actually more appropriate for business and maybe for the garden are the notions of generation or regeneration. It's an appreciation that we actually have to create more than we take out, rather than just sustain what we have. We have to invest for the future to generate more than we have now. And this is fundamentally what's not happening in our culture, in our world, in our society. We are extracting and using up resources, and we're depleting the limited resources that we have. Somehow we can blame Descartes or some offspring of his thinking, but we keep thinking that resources are unlimited. And we know now, looking at our planet and the resources of water and air and soil on it, that they are limited. And we are using them up much faster than ever before in just a blink of an eye in 100-year industrial period. And so what I've been trying to do is understand more about how things grow by dedicating more time in a garden. I've been gardening in this particular piece of land for about 18 years, and it really teaches you about the appreciation of having a long view. It also teaches you to appreciate that you don't have control over everything. I think we like to think we have control, you know, and again, in business school, we teach a lot about strategy and planning and execution, just as if we have control, but we don't. We are subject to forces much greater than us. And I think all of this comes into real focus in food. And that's why I've been, you know, studying and teaching more about food systems, because food systems is where we connect intimately and personally with how things grow, the resources required, and how what we grow nourishes us and also nourishes our friends and community and family and the world. And it really puts us front and center in a system, takes us out of something that's kind of intellectual or conceptual.
Yeah.
So idea gardening, I've called my garden the idea garden just because I like to think that it's a safe environment to entertain ideas. And also it always reminds me that for an idea to take root and flourish, the conditions for success have to be set up in advance. One of my friends, you know, asked me recently, like, well, what are you going to do in the garden today? Today is almost May, and frankly, today I'm just going to enjoy it. Most of the hard work was done in, you know, November through March, when there was a lot of pruning to do and a lot of clearing and a lot of, you know, clearing the soil and feeding the soil and composting and things like that. So, you know, you also learn a lot about cycles and spurts. You come to appreciate that we all go through dormant cycles, and that we need to, at least for me, I'm learning, it's taking me a long time, but I'm learning that these dormant cycles are so critical to getting that source of regeneration, because we can't just, you know, go full speed all the time. And just one other thought, Lynn, that I wanted to share was in just the last couple weeks, some of the entrepreneurs that have been in my classes have been really struggling with, investor relations that weren't set up properly. Mm-hmm. They're really struggling now in their businesses. They're kind of a couple years into it. Things are actually going well, but there's not alignment or agreement among the shareholders and the founders, and it's inhibiting them from growing further. The trust has dissolved, and they're in very painful situations. They're kind of trapped. They can't, you know, they can't go forward. They can't really get out. And, you know, I just wanted to mention that because I know, you know, we wanted to talk about the business lessons, but from the garden, I just so appreciate that if you don't set things up for success, you're going to fail. You can create, you know, a spectacular short bloom or illusion, which is what you often see in a nursery, because plants have been fed, you know, super fertilizers, and they've gotten a lot of, you know, heat and attention right before they're, you know, gloriously sort of for sale. But that will die. That plant doesn't have strong roots. So you really have to take your time. I like to think of it as you have to slow down to grow fast. You have to set things up. You have to do the hard work. Sometimes we get carried away with how exciting the possibilities of something are, and we don't kind of rigorously think about what resources are going to be required and what design and what agreements and what governance is going to best support the long-term shared vision of an enterprise.
And you know, one of the things when I think about idea gardening, one of the business words that we hear a lot is scale, which is very mechanistic. And so we see these returns, the hockey stick outcome. But I think what you're talking about, sort of the vibrancy and the ecosystemic perspective, the yield, the harvest of that, growth can be so much more exponential. It reminds me of that time you told me that, like, the rose bushes had all leafed out overnight. Growth is so far beyond, like, the hockey stick up. So doing all that tending and all of that designing in the beginning, it bears more fruit potentially as well.
One of the things that's often forgotten in today's, you know, capitalistic democracy is we tend to think, the market wants to think that it can just keep growing, that growth is exponential. And Donella Meadows wrote, you know, many years ago about limits to growth, and that we exist in systems. And so gardening, and a lot of people tell me, oh, I don't have a green thumb. Gardening just requires attention and continuous engagement and care and encouragement and resourcefulness. And so that practice is so, to me, vital for creating the kinds of businesses that the world needs. I do believe that in the world that we exist in, that business is going to prevail, and it can prevail in a positive way, or it can continue to extract and mistreat and, you know, tromp down and not think about potential, or not think about, you know, encouragement of human beings and, you know, the systems we work in.
So
let me just jump in real quickly. I just wanted to do a brief announcement that if we have opened up the queues, and we're going to start the Q&A at some point soon. If you'd like to jump in, press *6 if you are called in. If you'd like to email us a question, you can do that. You can also send us anonymous comments, and we'll carry forward those themes. So this is a good time for you to share your questions and comments for Will and for Lynn to transition to her fourth key pillar, I think.
Yes,
you said
well, we're
there
right
were four
there.
Words,
we're,
right?
We're right there. We're right there with what Will has just said. So the optimal outcome is something like eudaimonia, one of Will's favorite words. And so the short definition that I looked up is it's beyond human being, it is human flourishing. And so maybe this should be the goal, perhaps, of all venture, ideally. And in my mind, when I think of a visual definition of eudaimonia, it's any image I've ever seen of Will's garden. Most recently, the irises are going crazy, and someone actually used the word on Facebook. They said, that looks like the definition of flourishing. So, Will, how do you describe eudaimonia, and what can we learn? What can it teach us?
Let's just spell it for people, Lynn. It's E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A, E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A. It goes back to the ancient Greeks, Aristotle and Plato and Epicurus and Marcus Aurelius. The Stoics picked it up, but it doesn't really have a great English translation. It was translated kind of simply as happiness, this notion of cultivating happiness, but it's really more about, it's not individual happiness, it's kind of collective happiness. And then as other people have done more work on it, it's really about flourishing. And it's an intention. Eudaimonia is an intention to achieve, or it's the desire to achieve or create or generate. Eudaimonia is this notion of creating, supporting human flourishing. And I just love that because, you know, when you think about like the purpose of a organization or a business enterprise, rarely, if ever, would you see a goal of generating human flourishing as one of its desired outcomes. You always hear, well, we want to generate a profit for our stakeholders. We want our customers to love us and be happy. We'd like our employees to feel good about working here. But this eudaimonia goes way beyond that. And so I'm just starting to think about the ways that my actions and those that I get to collaborate with, how we can set an intention and a goal to actually create flourishing in the communities and organizations that we're part of, in the same way that we do in a garden. You know, we really look for, the gardener does, hopes to create full bloom, and full bloom over the season, or, you know, beautiful fruit or vegetables. We work hard knowing that that fleeting moment will come where there is something to harvest and then hopefully cook and share and eat. And it's a cycle. And it's a cycle that generates a lot of happiness. So I've just been trying to think about, instead of fettered growth, just in that one hockey stick direction, Lynn, to this more cyclical, regenerative cycles, where in the process of creating goods and services and solving problems in the marketplace, we are also first and fundamentally generating human flourishing. And there's some, you know, wonderful things written about this, and it's kind of a lost word. When I give talks or when I'm teaching, I'll ask people, have you ever heard of that word? And it's kind of been lost from our vocabulary and from our mental models. And I think, you know, there's a great time to bring it back, and maybe this awakened community, service-based community, will resonate with this concept and think about what design principles or what cultivation activities can generate eudaimonia.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Lynn, I don't know if you have another question, but there's a whole bunch of questions that folks have kind of come together with.
Great. Why don't you go, and then if there's any time left, I have a couple of things.
Okay. And you're welcome to jump in if one of the themes comes about too. But okay. Will, thank you for sharing your journey. I mean, it's incredible and gives us a real taste of who you are and the values you stand for. There's a whole cluster of sort of questions around food. You know food. But food is, at this point, maybe 20 years ago, we didn't have enough food to feed everybody in the world. Today, that is no longer the case. We have lots of food, but food is a really political issue. I mean, food insecurity, hunger. Washington Post did this story on just last month on how 20 million people are starving because there's a famine. And they listed, I think, something like at least 8 or 9 countries that this was true for, where all these famines are caused just primarily due to wars. And so I know you, you know, on one side, you really come at it with this great compassion and this spirit of interconnectedness. And on the other side, I know you're very steeped into the food world. So can you share some insights into how, in your view, what is the current state of the world and how can we apply some of these ideas of human flourishing when it comes to food and compassion and solve some of these issues which seem to be very hard for us to solve as a humanity?
Well, getting deep into food really requires a shift of mindset from this kind of mechanistic, extractive, techno-centered orientation to ecosystems and interdependencies. And, you know, some of the issues you mentioned, Nipun, you know, I would add to them that 7 out of the 10 lowest paying jobs in the United States are in the food industry. So the people who are harvesting the food and cooking the food or bringing the food to your table in a restaurant, so many of them are not paid enough to be able to buy the food that many of us get to enjoy when we go out to a restaurant. There's a lot of inequity. There's a lot of injustice in the entire food system. The good news is that we're coming into an era where the eaters in the world, the, as Lynn likes to say, the prosumers, or the citizens of the world who are eating and becoming enlightened eaters, are calling for transparency. They want to know where the food comes from, how it's grown, what was, you know, put on the food or this in the soil. They want to know how it was handled. They want to know who's prepared it. And increasingly, we are getting tools and connectivity to help us understand that. I mean, this is happening in the world of seafood, where there is, you know, rapid scarcity, and there's been a lot of really good work in sustainable seafood. It's very complicated. We have to change people's patterns and habits and tastes. You know, we know now that 45% of all climate impacts, of negative climate impacts in terms of carbon, are generated by industrial agriculture. And that's from us eating and, you know, producing and eating meat in a certain manner. We have, we're going to have 9 billion people on the planet with an appetite for meat. So there's a lot of exciting innovation going on right now to blend meat with vegetables, to replace meat with plant-based proteins, to help people change their preferences slightly, knowing that they're not really sacrificing a lot. So, I mean, in a nutshell, there are so many opportunities for people to participate in solving food systems problems. And you mentioned famine and starvation, and there's also a lot of, you know, nutritional stunting that happens when children don't get the right nutrients. Yeah. But as you mentioned, there's a lot of food on the planet. We have to get it to the right places, and we have to participate as individuals in solving this and not thinking it's going to be left to a government or some big company that has different, you know, incentives and motivations. So I would just encourage people to start locally, start in their own community, start where they know the landscape, so to speak. And, you know, there's a wonderful online resource called Civil Eats that talks about kind of just and fair eating. And they have a wonderful resource for people. It's probably kind of U.S.-centric, but nonetheless, it's really useful. It lists about 40 different organizations that one can get involved with if they want to participate in creating a more healthy and sustainable food system.
For sure. There was a beautiful, there's so many interesting angles on this. I suppose you have been involved with Physics Ventures, and you've been investing in a lot of food-based innovations. And so there's this tempting tendency to, in terms of the innovation world, to focus on technology. But and say that, hey, look, if 45% of the negative climate impact is coming from agriculture and our food sort of particularly meat, can we just create synthetic foods? And then you start going further and further down that track, and you essentially arrive at Soylent, which is, you just pop this artificial thing into your body and you take all the food requirements away. There's someone in our building that gets like their weekly supply of Soylent. So I see that all the time. Versus a very different approach, say something like a Blue Apron, which is really trying to create, trying to use technology to make it easier for you to get your vegetables and for you to connect with local produce. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I think you're illuminating the difference in paradigms. I mean, Soylent is a reductionist, kind of mechanistic, technically driven idea that, gee, let me just get you all the basic nutrients you need in the most efficient manner. And that just completely ignores all that is beautiful about food. Food, we are what we eat. Yeah. And, if you want to just be a collection of nutrients, fine. But if you'd like to be, beautiful and alive and vibrant and, a source of inspiration and energy and output for others, then you're going to embrace, the thousands and thousands year old cultural history that food has played in our lives. And I think what worries me a little bit is that with all of the celebrification of Silicon Valley and technology and all of the media hype that technology gets, is that it's going to be like losing a rare heirloom seed that, it was the most beautiful cantaloupe anybody ever grew. And because somebody wasn't paying attention, we're just going to lose it out of the human, out of our sort of cultural heritage. And if we, it's not that we don't need technology. We certainly need technology. And technology has played an amazing role in making food more affordable and accessible and, and even more nourishing in some ways. But it's not just technology. Technology is one piece of a complex puzzle. And you mentioned another company, and the contrast there is they're taking a systems approach. They're looking at how do we nurture local food systems to produce seasonal, healthy, nutritious, regenerative products to people when they need them, and also encouraging and making it easy for people to cook at home is a great proven, scientifically efficacious, proven way to help people be healthier. I mean, Harvard School of Public Health's done a lot of work showing that people who cook at home for themselves are actually much healthier and avoid many of the chronic diseases or forestall them. Diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease that are a result of an unhealthy food system and diet.
Yeah. I mean, you're also teaching and addressing a lot of younger folks with your edible education. What is the angle you take there? Because with younger people, I can imagine this sort of fascination with this technology and maybe this reductionism that is embedded in that. And you're clearly coming at it from a different angle. Like, what have you found to be useful in terms of getting this idea through to the younger folks, the undergrads that use your
program? Well, we work on understanding how our actions interact and affect the food system. I like to think of that the class edible education is about developing food systems intelligence and a point of view and understanding where we stand and then taking a stand and then realizing that the actions we take actually have an impact on the whole food system. So it's a little bit like the butterfly effect. We each individually can have such a profound effect on the way the food system goes by what we buy, by what we put in our bodies, by what we support in terms of agriculture. If we're mindless or basically just kind of being blind, or, you know, let's just say we're participating in the opacity that the commercial system likes to create, you know, confusing labels, confusing names, confusing jargon, you know, the sort of instant gratification that everybody has come to expect in our technologically driven world. We lose sense of what's really happening. So the classes are kind of, they're really fun. They're about waking up. They're about participation and action. And we talk a lot about transparency, and I try to have the students think about how they can develop the superpower of kind of X-ray vision so that they can peer into the system and really understand how all the parts are connected and what's happening and what's just and equitable and what might not be, what's healthy and what's not, what's sustainable and what's not, from their own point of view. I don't profess to, you know, preach a certain way. I actually get a lot of complementary and competing opinions and views. And we look at public policy, we look at law, we look at science, we look at technology and economics, and we look at labor rights. We look at all of these facets of what makes up the food system, not just the super obvious ones. And you know, from what I could tell, this is like a transformative experience for people. And it's also known that it's during the college years that one's habits are most set up for how they will eat for the rest of their lives.
Really? Wow.
So, yeah, and that's millions and millions of meals. You know, it's when people leave home, they leave, you know, they leave those patterns or cultural patterns. Some are rich in food traditions, and unfortunately some are not. But when they get to college, they start making choices on their own, living on their own, that tend to set up their health and well-being, which in turn affects the sustainability of the way we live on this planet, and then ultimately leads to a state of eudaimonia or not.
Yeah. And you're teaching this class with Alice Waters, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, what's it like to work with Alice? I mean, she's...
Well, Alice, yeah, Alice is the, you know, she's the catalyst for this course. This was her idea. She has a foundation called the Edible Schoolyard Project. And if you want to see the course lectures, they're on edibleschoolyardproject.org. The course all semester was live streamed from Berkeley, from the Haas School of Business, where it's situated now. It started in the journalism school 5 years ago with Michael Pollan, and then it moved to the College of Natural Resources with Mark Bittman, and then this year it moved to the Haas School of Business with me. And Alice is really the standard bearer of the organic movement. I mean, she's been more than 40 years really advocating for organic agriculture, local agriculture, for appreciating the bounty of the seasons. She's been kind of a tireless educator, and she started this wonderful program in Oakland and Berkeley a number of years ago to actually plant gardens at schools and then teach kids how to cook. And it's simple, it's low tech, but again, it's completely transformative in terms of one's worldview. So she's a legend. She is one of the true kind of leaders of the food movement. She's uncompromising in her ways. We don't agree on everything. I think she, you know, has a worldview that is very particular and doesn't necessarily reach in this moment in time broad swaths of the global population, but she holds the ideal. And for that, I'm really grateful, you know, for her leadership and her mentorship of me and her generosity. I mean, she has enormous amount of energy, which manifests as generosity of giving of herself to spark the interest of others. And when she comes to class, she doesn't come every week, but when she comes, the students just love it. Also, she is, you know, kind of the focal point of some controversy and protests. We had animal rights people in our, it's Berkeley, don't forget, Nipun, you were there. It's still the capital of the free speech movement, despite what's going on right now in the world. And, you know, so we've actually had protesters in the class, too, who don't particularly appreciate that she still serves meat at Chez Panisse. But nonetheless, she takes it in, you know, good stride. She, you know, promotes free speech in the classroom. And, you know, she's just an inspiration to many, many people.
Wow. Are your courses live streamed, or is there a MOOC? How can people tune into that?
Yeah, they're live streamed, and then they're also captured on video so people can follow along. The syllabus is also on that Edible Schoolyard site. There's a Facebook page called Edible Schoolyard, no, Edible Education 101 at Berkeley Haas, Edible Education 101 at Berkeley Haas. There's a Facebook page that I think catalogs the classes. And then next year, in spring 2018, we'll offer it again, and I'm hoping that I can turn it into some kind of a open enrollment class so that people around the world can participate in the entire class, not just the lectures.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I know Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley did something like that, and they had 100,000 people for their Science of Happiness course, and it was awesome to kind of spread these ideas to more people. And I can imagine with you and Alice, you guys would have quite an audience. So that's exciting. Just a quick comment. If you would like to jump in through voice, hit *6. And if you'd like to share comments, you can continue doing so by online in various ways, including ask@servicespace.org. We have Mish in Brooklyn, New York, who has sent in a comment. She says, "You have encouraged me about my times of dormancy and slowing down. I can now look upon them as times of replenishment." Awesome. Thank you for the many gems that you have shared today. I want to take the next question in the direction of spirituality. Will, I think the person that introduced the both of us was incredible elder named Jacob Needleman, you know, that's somebody I think you really deeply resonate with, and I'm sure you have other spiritual elders that you look up to. I'm wondering how, in your journey, how you would describe the weaving in of spirituality. I mean, clearly gardening is a spiritual process because of if it's ecosystem view. But also tea, you know, your tea has been historically an incredible source of spiritual sort of practice, right? I was in Japan and I went to a tea ceremony and it was just like, it just felt so sacred. So what, you know, you seem to, maybe by the virtue of serendipity, you seem to gravitate around a lot of very interesting things that sort of have one foot in this world and one foot in the other. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that other, that spiritual world, and how that is most presently intersecting with your manifest work in the world.
It's all around us. You know, and another moment of serendipity, Nipun, was I met Jacob Needleman because he had a book called Money and the Meaning of Life published simultaneously with the Republic of Tea back in 1992.
Oh.
And Doubleday, it was the same publisher. Doubleday had organized book tour for me and had organized a book tour for him. And all of a sudden, you know, we had had this first Iran-Iraq war back then, and Doubleday decided that they were going to put all of their eggs behind General Schwarzkopf's biography or autobiography. And so at the last minute, they reconfigured our book tours to go on the book tour together.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so Jerry and I were sent out on multiple book signings together, you know, and that was, again, the most remarkable experience for me. And I learned so much from him. And I just talked to him the other day. He's just a dear, dear friend, special mentor. He's also a magician. So it turned out we both loved magic growing up. And whenever we get together, we're always talking about things. He wrote an amazing, he's written like 17 books. I highly recommend them. Money and the Meaning of Life for any entrepreneur on this, or anybody that is wondering about the spiritual energy of money. That is the best book. He also wrote a book called Sorcerers, which was a novel about his childhood growing up in this kind of group of nerdy kids that loved magic. But, you know, I think, Nipun, what I've learned is that developing a practice that has some continuity that transcends all the different, you know, jobs or roles or personas or things that you might have in your life. I mean, we're living longer. I just saw a book called The 100-Year Life on the shelf. It's not going to be long before people can expect to live 100 years. It's going to create a whole bunch of other questions. But I think having a practice that literally grounds us, that quiets us, that replenishes us, that takes us out of this sort of rapid transactional hypnosis that we, you know, fall into. I just feel like so much of our attention and our energy and even our you know, our vital energy, our money is being usurped unknowingly. You know, I don't know if you saw this on Facebook, but there's this game that people are playing about, you know, list the 10 concerts you went to and one you didn't go to. And, you know, and I saw that and I thought, and I see all these people like jumping in and doing that. And it looks like fun. But what you don't know and what you don't see is that somebody probably, and this, I hope this doesn't sound cynical, but somebody probably conceived that as a way of getting a lot of information about people, because that says a lot about people. If you know 9 concerts that they went to and one that they didn't, if you've got a data analytics company and you can scrape together millions of pieces of data and then identify it to an individual person, you can know a lot about what that person's likes, what they might, you know, what they might prefer over something else, where they might stand politically, how old they might be. And all of that information now is being used either to sell you more stuff or to influence your perspective. I mean, we've just seen our last election, you know, interfered with by another, you know, government. And so we're coming, I don't mean to sound dark about this, but
we gotta
wake up. We gotta wake up about what people's motivations and forces are. And that's why I think, you know, having a practice that quiets you and again enlivens your ability to perceive what is, not the way you'd like it to be, but to see things the way they are, to be in the moment, to use that moment to generate new energy, new potential and possibility, new commitment, so that you can show up and so that serendipity can work in your favor. We need this, you know, and I probably saved myself thousands of hours of therapy and the associated costs by gardening. So I would encourage people, start small. Don't be intimidated. Just, you know, make yourself a nice cup of tea. Use tea leaves. You know, warm the pot. There's a wonderful saying, Nipun, for tea drinkers. It says, as I drink my tea, I stop the war. And so having these kind of momentary experiences that pull us into something bigger than ourselves, I think is just a requirement to cope with the pace of change, the uncertainty, the feeling of risk and threat and alienation that are permeating our culture. And in doing so, we can bring so much more to those that we, you know, care about, work with, even those that we don't, to the very work that you do at Service Space of just bringing kindness and care in gross size in total, you know, into the world.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, that's beautiful. As I drink my tea, I stop the war. As we pause, we stop the violence. That's just great. You're speaking of kindness and connection, and I know we're at the tail end, and there's still a bunch of people that have figured out that you were you running TED conferences before Chris Anderson? Is that right? Were you the executive director of TED?
Yeah, I went to the first TED conference. That was another serendipitous moment in my life, and that was in 1984.
Okay.
And after that, first conference was life-changing for me, but unfortunately was not a was not a success. The original founders, Richard Saul Werman and Harry Marks, had, you know, some challenges with it and were, you know, hadn't made any plans to do it again. And I went to them. I was like a 27-year-old whippersnapper. And I said, hey, that conference changed my life. It showed me how converging disciplines and sectors come together to create something new. I think this technological kind of innovation wave is going to be big. And I think TED could actually be a business. What do you think about letting me kind of rekindle it? And so they said yes, and I stepped in, and I was the executive director of TED2, which restarted it. And, you know, it carried on for a number of years before Chris Anderson acquired it and, you know, turned it into something a little bit different. Chris has certainly got phenomenal kind of media experience, and he managed to kind of open the source and system of the wisdom and make it available around the world. That was really his genius.
So that is true. That's amazing. But the question I was actually going to ask, although I know we're at the tail end of our call here, was around kindness and an act of kindness you've received. You said online there was actually, going to this theme of serendipity, you said that a friend who changed plans last minute, which ultimately led to you meeting your wife, and that's been a kindness that you're continuing to receive from. That's been a serendipity that you've been receiving from. So before we close, maybe that personal story?
Well, it's another very odd circumstance at Newark Airport. So for those of you that think Newark Airport is barren of all potential, I beg to differ. I still go there over Kennedy. But, yeah, I had been teaching at Princeton, and I was supposed to leave the next day, and the colleague that I was with offered to rush me to the airport so I could get home, and I made a run for a plane. I got a last seat on a plane, and then the plane was delayed, and I was starving, and I went into the TGIF there in the United Terminal, and I bought a sandwich and a beer, and I wheeled around, and I noticed that there was nowhere to sit, and you can't leave with a beer, so you're kind of confined in that little area, and it turned out there was a person sitting at a table that had one chair that was empty, and I kind of uncharacteristically shyly went over there and asked if I could sit down, and that person turned out to be my beloved wife.
Wow.
So
amazing. It seems like your whole life, and perhaps all our lives, are full of this if we just take a moment to observe it, notice it, to give it encouragement, I suppose.
I just encourage everybody to get to an outpost that is unfamiliar and uncomfortable, because that's where the journey and the serendipity begin.
Beautiful. And are there ways, Will, that are, before we go into our collective minute of silence, are there ways that the larger service-based ecosystem can support you, can support your work, the values you stand for? What would you recommend for people tuning in?
Well, I am in awe and grateful, Nipun, for the spirit of organization that you've brought to Spirit Space. I think it represents a new model of energy, collaboration, and impact. And I would be grateful to learn from Service Space members and to hear from Service Space members who might like to work on these food systems issues, and particularly in making education more accessible and more vital on a local basis. I've got a lot of ideas about how to do that, but I could certainly use a lot of smart people who understand education, digital media, communication. So if anyone would like to be part of that effort, I would certainly like to hear from them.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, we do these 21-day challenges. We have a portal dedicated to that, and it literally has, I think, over 1,000 challenges. But it would be amazing to try to do a 21-day edible eats challenge or a 21-day food challenge or, you know, something of this sort that really gets people into 21 days of just mindfulness around not just what they're putting in, but how it's generated and going deeper into its roots. So
let's do it.
Yeah, let's definitely keep the conversation going. Thank you all for being on the call. Thank you, Lynn, for really doing some amazing, bringing out some great stories from way back in the high school days. That is a gem. And thank you, Will, for just being who you are. You know, there are so many beautiful things you shared today. We're going to put up the audio of this call. We're going to have volunteers going to transcribe this by hand as their labor of love and gratitude to who you are. And we hope that the ripples will continue on, so we'll certainly keep all of that in motion. Thank you all. I'm just going to unmute all the lines. So for those of you that are still on the count of three, we will all say thank you, Will. So on the count of three, here we go. One, two, and three. Thank you,
thank
Will.
You, thank you, Will. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Will. Yeah. Oh. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Nipun. Thank you, Lynn. Have a great day.
You too. We'll be in touch.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.